Thanks to all of you for being here, and it's really a great honor to be able to speak to all of you and to get a chance to speak with Jan about subjects that he is one of the world experts on. And maybe as a first topic, we have realized that in many ways we don't share a vocabulary in talking about the world, in talking about the cosmos. And even the term cosmology is a point of some disagreement. So I wonder if you could just recall for us what came to mind. What did you think of when we asked, is the Anthropocene a cosmology?
Yeah, it was fascinating because we knew we had to speak with each other, and then John emailed me and said, wouldn't it be great, you know, to think of the Anthropocene, you know, in terms of cosmology? And I thought about it. I said, yeah, that's fine, absolutely. That would work really well. And then we corresponded some more, and it became clear I had completely the wrong end of the stick. And being a, you know, typical barbarian scientist and, you know, not knowing much of this wider culture, John was referring to quite a different form of cosmology to the one that I had in my head. You know, so I guess the one I had in my head was the scientific view of the cosmos, the universe. And the Anthropocene fits into that in a number of ways, but the way that popped into my head as a geologist, as an old-fashioned, straightforward, you know, mud on my knees geologist, is that we spend a lot of our time trying to work out Earth history and match it up from one part of the world to another. So it's not history in one place, but it's a history of the world, and what we do is we correlate between rock sections in Germany and Great Britain and China and South America. And one of the we look for material evidence in the strata for history. And one of the things we have done as humans in the Anthropocene is to take that material evidence out to other planets. So now on the moon there is remains of a number of spaceships, a golf club and a golf ball or two left out there. We now have bits of working and non-working spaceships on Mars. We have one that has landed on Titan. We have a couple that have landed on Venus very briefly in there. So we have put out, if you like, a time plane for the first time in 4.5 billion years of this the history of the solar system. Of if you like, an Anthropocene, part of an Anthropocene layer, a net, if you like, a timeline drawn between. So that's what came into my head. And then it became clear that John had a quite different, if you like, world view of how it, and indeed meaning of the word cosmology.
Yeah. It's true.
So,
And that view I do also understand, right? That is the standard Western scientific cosmology, which is a subfield of astrophysics, which is about the extent of the universe, its origins, when it ends, as Cecilia reminded us. And it is something that is studied out there, right? That we observe with concepts and tools, methods of objective science. As an historian of science, that is something I'm very interested in seeing the origins of. How does that conception, the concepts we now have of the universe, come into existence? When, through what actions, on the basis of what evidence, does this naturalist conception of the universe come into existence? But as somebody with earlier training in cultural anthropology, another conception of cosmology is there, which is, yes, the theory of what exists in the universe, but also questions about where humans stand in relation to what's in the universe. The order of things, but in physical terms, as well as in moral, aesthetic, religious terms that come from the side of meaning and from intention. So cosmology for anthropologists is not exactly, but it's close to culture. It's a way of seeing the world. What counts as significant in the world? What are the choices that are good and what are bad choices? What is the order of the heavens, just as in scientific cosmology? But also, what's the order of the plants? What's the order of the animals? What's the order of human society? So sociological elements fit into anthropological cosmology as well. It's a way of seeing the world, it's a way of theorizing the world, but as anthropologists show through their work in doing ethnography, in participant observation, those concepts are not just written down in texts, they're not just communicated in symbols, they're also lived. They're part of everyday practice. They're part of what Bourdieu calls a habitus, right? It's a scheme of interpretation that's tied into what people do every day with each other, with in interaction with others, and with concrete things. So the social, the moral, the aesthetic, the religious, as well as the natural, all are woven together in a cosmology. So to ask the question, is the Anthropocene a cosmology? And to answer it the way Jan at first did, that makes perfect sense within the standard framework of the sciences. But to ask it anthropologically, to ask it in terms of, well, what is our system of belief, not just about the physical world, but the system that includes the notion that there's a division between the physical world and the world of meaning. What changes in our cosmology when we start to think of the Anthropocene? That is, a natural world which is affected by, transformed by human intentions and motivations. And I guess I can say something about that. I've thought a little bit about what that might be, and I'm sure we're going to hear, and we have heard a lot about that already today, and we will in the next couple days. But one of the systems of thought that I referred to that makes sense when thinking about cosmology is a fairly recent book by an anthropologist named Philippe Descola, Beyond Nature and Culture, which claims that there are basically four types of cosmology across the entire cultural record in all the societies of the world. And one of them is the naturalist cosmology. That's the one we live in, and for Descola, Descartes, as a good French rationalist, epitomizes it. Descartes' view of the world that there's thinking substance and extended substance, and those are two separate things, that's basically the common sense naturalist viewpoint of people in the West. But in addition, there is, according to Descola, animism, which imagines that, or which inhabits a world, right? This is an ontological view. This is a view of what is in the world. According to animism, there may be differences between physical objects, between, say, myself and a bird or a plant. But inside, we all have a possibility of intentionality, of life. And there was a conference here last year on animism, and it seems to be an idea which is taking on a lot of steam. It seems to have a lot of life. Totemism is another possibility, that certain animals are seen as having the same internal and external qualities as certain members of certain tribes. And in Australia, that's the cosmology that holds sway there. And finally, according to Descola, there's a fourth general type of cosmology, which is that of analogism, which is a world which is imagined as full of multiple differences at every level, but where it's possible to find large analogies between different domains of existence. Okay, so the Renaissance in the West is analogous, and he also believes that Chinese cosmology is analogous. So how does that help us in thinking about the Anthropocene? Have we left the naturalist framework is the main question. And I think some of the conversations I've already heard today and that I've heard elsewhere are suggesting that, yes, we have. We've moved into something like an animist framework. We've begun to imagine that the world, the natural world, the non-human world, has capacities and thoughts, intentions, or at least an ability to act in unpredictable ways that make it somewhat similar to a human. Right? We grant it moral capacities just as we grant ourselves moral capacities. But we can think a little more about that down the line.
Yeah. Or perhaps we can even think in the other way around, in that humans may have rather more of the qualities of the natural world than sometimes we flatter ourselves that we do not have. You know, for instance, we are primates. We share, I think, 97% of our genome with the chimpanzee. You know, we are clearly very closely related, you know, to organisms that we would push outside of ourselves into what we would call nature. And in terms of being, you know, what we do and what we're driven by, you know, there have been people, you know, Desmond Morris originally, for instance, who would say that we're often driven rather more by our, you know, innate drives of various sorts rather than by a sense of, you know, philosophy or rationality. And of course, part of that and part of what we would like rather than what we think is best, ultimately, it could well be a factor pushing the Anthropocene in the kind of direction it's going into and at the speed it's going into as well.
And I think we want to keep that in mind as one of the possibilities in the conversations that are going to be happening here, that even as we heard at dinner last night, there's a way, there's the Anthropocene invites us to think of humanity as being a natural thing like any other thing, right? That it follows the same kind of causality as natural objects. We are, in making claims like that, generally applying the naturalistic conception of the world as predictable, as you say, not driven by intentionality, as having intrinsic natural laws that are outside of mentation, outside of thought, outside of interpretation. And while certainly we want to incorporate the thinking of a range of natural sciences, at the same time, I think there's a real concern that we not simply bring in the sciences to replace the interpretive arts, the Geisteswissenschaften or the humanities, that in addition, we need to humanize the sciences, not merely naturalize the humanities. And hopefully this is a place where that can occur to an extent. One of the ways in which sociologists of science, historians of science do that, that is to show the facts about the natural world as part of culture, as part of science, is to ask about what kinds of activities, what kinds of social organizations and institutions house the facts of the world. Through what kinds of interactions, through what kinds of social organizations, does an image of the world, in naturalistic terms, get imposed? And here, we're talking with someone who is involved in this directly in the case of the Anthropocene. You work for the Stratigraphy Commission. You're a member of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You don't work for it, but you're a member of it. And that means one of the things that you are trying to do is persuade people that the Anthropocene is indeed an epoch, which should be added to the geological record. Is that true?
Or? Well, it's perhaps not quite. Persuade is not the word. What our job, again, this is part of the scientific world, and particularly, I think, with the Anthropocene, which is, one can technically describe as a hot potato in geology at the moment, we have to try and be as, in one sense, as dispassionate as we can about it. It is a new concept. The Anthropocene, the idea that humans are changing the world. And for geologists, the important part is not the human part. The important thing, as we try and describe Earth history, what we try and do is we try and describe the history of the Earth going back 4.5 billion years and fit ourselves into it, is not that humans are here and changing things. The important thing is that the world is being changed substantially to a degree that the record of that change, that is preserved in the sands and muds now forming in lakes and rivers and in the sea and in soils, if that were to be fossilized and carried forward 10 million years, 100 million years, that will look so different from previous strata that any visiting alien, say, coming in and trying to become an earthling geologist would say, something happened here, the world's history changed here, and the world went from one state to another, and we would have a geological boundary. I think that is the logic of the Anthropocene. And of course, what we have to do is, we are not far in the future, we are now. So what we have to do is think in almost two levels. The far in the future, how does this fit in? The far in the past, how does what is happening now compare with events going back 50, 100 million years ago? And also, in the now, what changes are being made to the world, to the biology, to the chemistry, to the physics of the world? And of course, something that is not really part of our professional concern, But it's something that we are nevertheless concerned about because of the human aspect, is what will the Anthropocene do to us as it evolves? So there are a number of levels, but I guess the primary level that that I work on, and I'm part of a group called the Anthropocene Working Group, and it is looking to see whether the Anthropocene can be formalized. It can become an Anthropocene period or an Anthropocene epoch, and it can go into the geological timescale formally together with the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and all those other epochs. And to do that, we have to play it straight down the line, and we have to look at the pros as and the cons simultaneously, the evidence for, the evidence against.
Well, my guess is that many of the people who are here are already persuaded that this is a good concept to think with, or at least it's an mm-hmm. intriguing one to think with. What is the state of play among the people you need to convince? Are you feeling like people, how do you have to convince them? Who do you have to convince? What kinds of arguments will be the right kinds of ones to make this cosmological definition stick?
To give it the stamp of you know, authority and approval and formality. Well, really what we have to do is we have to demonstrate that the products of the Anthropocene are sufficiently distinct from those of earlier times in geology, that is, from earlier strata, to be recognized and classified as Anthropocene by working scientists, particularly Earth scientists, but also others, oceanographers, ecologists, and so on. But the geologists, you know, again, we're talking, the Anthropocene turns everything upside down, unfortunately. Everything, in terms of our procedures. Firstly, with every other period in the past, the Precambrian, the Cambrian, the Carboniferous, the Cretaceous, and so on, one has always started with the evidence, with the rock strata. People have gone to look for those for pleasure and profit and worked out a history slowly, painstakingly, over decades and indeed centuries from those, and eventually worked out the history. A sequence of events in Earth history covering hundreds, thousands of millions of years, in which at some times the world changed significantly, distinctly, permanently. And those are the, if you like, the main marker layers we choose as a boundaries. It is easy to tell Cretaceous strata below from Tertiary strata above because the world changed. The dinosaurs disappeared, lots of other creatures disappeared, the mammals came in, lots of other creatures came in, so the strata are easier to tell apart. That is the evidence. And indeed, there is a whole, we have two forms of time. We have the normal time that everybody deals with, and we have something called time rock. It's a parallel system, which is the time of the evidence. There is a Jurassic period, when the dinosaurs lived and so on, and the Jurassic system, which is all of the strata which were formed during the Jurassic. So for the Anthropocene, we as geologists have to think not just of Anthropocene history, everything that is going on, but the Anthropocene material record, which includes the soil outside on you know, beneath the grass. It includes the sediments in the river that flows through Berlin. It includes the sediments on the seafloor, on the beaches. And again, we have to turn our heads inside out. It includes, we look at fossils. I'm a paleontologist, so I look at bones. I look also at tracks and trails and footprints. Well, the Haus der Kulturen der Welt is a wonderful trace fossil. It is made of eminently geological materials. It can be preserved in the right circumstances. And we have made it, and it is a piece of geology. So again, this is part of a material record that we look at. And because it's new, we're not used to looking at that. So we are having to, if you like, alter our own internal cosmology, you know, in this. And I presume, again, John has looked a lot at the way people have altered their cosmologies and their worldviews, you know, particularly in the last couple of centuries, in what one might call early Anthropocene times.
So earlier you mentioned that when you're making the case, you don't want to put the emphasis on the human aspect. You want to put the emphasis on the evidence.
On the evidence, on
the geological evidence.
Yeah.
So does that mean you, in arguing about it, remove your sense of the causes? Or is it simply that you try to remove the kind of red siren saying this is a crisis that we've caused? Just to are you trying to remove any moralizing judgment? Or are you also removing, you just want to talk about things you can observe and not making guesses about what caused them?
Yeah, at that level, we certainly have to remove the moralizing, because as soon as, let's say, my colleagues on the various Strategic Commission begin to think that I might be trying to be a pressure group, part of a pressure group, begin to push people, begin, worse still, to moralize, then they will immediately give the Anthropocene big thumbs down. This thing has got to be, you know, to work geologically and formally, it has got to be simply evidence-based. Humans are very important because, of course, they're driving this. But the effect, it is the effects. It is the fact that, for instance, you know, as we've seen today, animals and plants, the fossils of the future, have been moved all around the world. And that effect, you know, will leave an imprint in the strata, you know, as those creatures fossilize. It is because we have moved mud and sand and gravel and rock all around the world to create the new strata, you know, including the part of it which is the house called Tudendadvelt in here. So it is the production of these things. There are also very non-human parts of that. We have started something which is going to go on. So let's say we have put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That has begun to cause a warming. As the warming proceeds over the next decades and centuries, that is going to start, more likely than not, to release large amounts of methane from the permafrost in Siberia, in Alaska, in Greenland, and so on. And that will then go into the atmosphere and cause a warming of its own. That will break down in 10 years into carbon dioxide, which will cause further warming. And that will be a purely physico-chemical effect, often repeated in the Earth's past. And we, by that stage, are one step removed. As being, we are, if you like, we lit the blue touch paper to the rocket, and the rocket has taken off and is working purely on physical and chemical and non-human biological principles. And it is still the Anthropocene, even though we have, by long time ago, maybe lost control over that particular aspect.
So sociologists often are very interested in very boring details. So forgive me, but I really want to know, who do you have to convince? Okay. Is it just 20 people on this commission, and does it go then to a higher power? And who appoints those people?
Right.
And who do they have to convince once right. they've agreed on the stamp? Are they somehow the rulers of the epochs? Are they the ones who determine for all time what the eras will be? Do you have, formally, is there another route? Are there further steps that need to be taken? Informally, is your Anthropocene group thinking about how to get this message out if this designation is given?
Okay, if our audience has the patience, I will now go through some bureaucracy for you, the bureaucracy
yes.
of time. The sets of time lords in increasing rank, as it were, in a hierarchy. First, right at the very bottom, there is me and my colleagues. On the Anthropocene Working Group and we are a group set up since 2009, since the Stratigraphic Commission of London finished some work, wrote a paper suggesting there was some sense, some geological sense in the Anthropocene. And then we were asked to form a working group, which we have. There are about 25, 28 of us, a few here at the meeting here, including, I say, Will Steffen, you know, who gave the keynote talk, you know, Earl Ellis and so on, and there are about 25 of us. About half geologists and half other people, because we have, you know, and that, again, that's a difference from the standard working group in geology. So we will work together for a few years to gather the evidence for and against the Anthropocene. Is it justifiable geologically? If so, when did it begin? That hasn't been fixed. Did it begin millennia ago, centuries ago, or did it begin, and the evidence is now really quite good, that a recognizable stratigraphic beginning is around about 1950, as Will Steffen said.
So not 1780, not
1780.
That
is when, if you like, the history began. That is when CO2 began to go up. But in terms of the evidence we see on the ground, in the sediments, a lot of the evidence, and the evidence, if I can just again say, is things like the radionuclides post-1945 and especially post-1950 with the above-ground A-bomb tests. We are all contaminated by those. All sand and mud around the world is contaminated by those, and we can measure that. There is nitrogen. We have changed the chemistry of nitrogen. We have changed the isotopic composition of reactive nitrates on the ground because we've pulled so much out of the air using the Haber-Bosch process. And you can measure that in lakes far from people, in Spitsbergen, in Canada, and so on. A lot of the evidence, metals, aluminium, is almost unknown geologically, native pure aluminium. We have created, since about 1950, about 500 million tons of the stuff. Enough, if you were to take, put it into standard kitchen foil, you could wrap the whole of the USA in aluminium kitchen foil, and a little bit more, a bit of Canada as well. I'm not suggesting we try and do that, but that is, if you like, and there's lots and lots of bits of that around, and cigarette paper and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the mass migrations of animals and plants. So 1950 is looking pretty good, but it is early days. We might change our minds still. We're geologists, we often do. So we will try and come to say how, if the Anthropocene is for real, geologically, it should be defined at such and such a level, by such and such a means, either by a reference level somewhere in some lake sediments, what's called a golden spike, or global boundary stratigraphic section and point.
Which is literally a golden spike.
It's literally a golden spike.
Like
it's
literally an object with a golden head. That's
well,
a
it's not
that literal.
It's usually a rusty iron spike, you know, to tell the truth. But yes, it is a level in strata to which everybody is a reference level for everybody. And it's usually been very well studied to have lots of biological, physical, chemical evidence below and above, and lots of other things have been studied to say that that reference level will work all around the world. You know, or we can simply choose a time. We can say it began, 1945, when the first A-bomb exploded in Alamogordo. And so what we then do is we put all the evidence together, probably in large volumes which would break your toe if it fell onto it, because there is a lot of evidence, you know, out there, and a lot we still have to make. And then we pass that up to our parent body, which is the next feeding level, as it were, of the Time Lords, which is the Subcommission on Quaternary Stratigraphy, the SQS. The whole subcommission is represents thousands, literally thousands, of people who work on the Quaternary period, the Ice Ages. And it has a secretariat. They are the people who will mainly look at it and say, we like that, we don't like that. If they don't like it, it simply stays. If they like it, they pass it up to the International Commission on Stratigraphy, which is made up of the chairs and the vice chairs of the subcommissions of all of the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, and so on and so on and so on, about 20 periods, about 20 sets of people, say maybe 40 odd people in total, and they will then decide. They will take a vote on it. In fact, they will argue a little bit, maybe a lot, and take a vote. If they then say yes, after this, after all of that, then the decision still has to be ratified by the International Union of Geological Sciences. And they can also say no. When the beginning of the Quaternary period was readjusted a few years ago, after long and bitter, I have to say, dispute, vehement dispute, the IUGS, first of all, threw it out. And it had to be reworded, re-rationalized, and then sent back again, and then they eventually took it. It's a long, very bureaucratic process. Geologists are incredibly reluctant to change the timescale because it is the backbone of all of geology. We deal in time more than anything else. We have 4.5 billion years. We have to cope with all of this time somehow, and so we try and have a stable timescale. And geologists are very reluctant to change that stability, either by changing something, by adding a new hooligan epoch, like the Anthropocene, in here, where the rules are changing, which is still happening, which is only beginning, and is five orders of magnitude shorter than the average epoch. yeah. in the time column. So we will have our work cut out to do this. The science will be wonderful. One of the great things about doing all this formal stuff is that you have to understand the phenomenon that you are trying to classify.
Yeah.
So what we really will have to do is take the Anthropocene to small pieces. The biology, the chemistry, you know, the physics, everything, you know, the anthropology, the archaeology, the cultural history, and so on, and really try and understand it between us and pass that understanding on as best as we can. And then only then can we say, okay, well, this then will be the best decision to make.
So is there a risk that in communicating this concept before that you've gone through this very onerous process,
yeah.
that you might be setting some forces unexpectedly against you in that,
yeah.
as you said, if it seems like you're an interest group,
yeah.
you're going to meet resistance right
yeah.
away.
Straight away.
Is
yeah.
there any danger that as the term takes off and really gets a life of its own, as is happening, yeah. That you may lose control of the term? Is there some worry about that?
I don't think we can lose control. We don't have control. What we have at the moment, I say we are the lowest level. You know, the geologists can simply turn around and say, no, we don't like this.
Right.
You know, even if we've worked for 10 years, produced 50 volumes, you know, that would break all of your toes if it fell on them. You know, they have the power to do that. We do not. We can propose. They will dispose.
Right. And then does smoke come out of the window?
Something. Well, it's...
Well, is there is there a policy of... I'm sure there are press releases made.
Yeah.
Is there thinking within your group, the Anthropocene group, but also within the Stratigraphy Commission, is there thinking about what comes next? I mean, this is a very focused project targeted at a very small number of people who are the experts in the field.
Who are the experts in the field.
Is there then, because clearly, despite the fact that you need to remove all of the alarmist rhetoric from the scientific arguments you're making, the reason you're making the arguments is out of a sense of alarm. For a lot of people. It's not just the fascination of this new wrinkle in the geological record.
That.
It's the anticipation of what comes next. So is there some thought, informally or even formally, about how to take this new definition, if it sticks, and communicate more broadly?
Yeah.
Because just thinking back, Stefan's referenced Darwin, for instance. And this is a change... perhaps even greater than Darwin's change, the change brought by Darwin in the understanding of the order of nature and the history of nature, right? The introduction of evolution and natural selection. That did not happen overnight, right? That took years of cultural preparation with theories that were similar to it, but different and unacceptable for various ways. Darwin himself held back for decades before publishing, before announcing what he'd done. And even then, the reception was very spotty. Many people weren't convinced. Various kinds of syncretic adaptations of Darwin were present for a very long time. And, as Dr. Sevens pointed out, it still hasn't taken across the board. So what kinds of steps are you thinking about to make this cosmological transformation down the line?
Well, the first point you make is very important, that we have to, we cannot be a pressure group. You know, we are a scientific body who are trying to look at this dispassionately. Now, of course, we are human, and we also develop ideas, and we consider that certain things are more likely than other. You know, I consider, having been involved with this now for a few years, is that the evidence that the Anthropocene is a real and significant geological phenomenon is pretty good. But knowing that, what I have to do is I have to balance that. So what I've done as chair of this body is simply to invite, if you like, enemies of the Anthropocene or people who are deeply skeptical of the idea, indeed, onto the working group, who are on the working group, and also to publish in volumes that we're publishing. So we have all of the evidence, pro and con, simply set out. You know, so it is... You know, the disagreement in science is commonplace. You know, we work with that. This is, in many ways, it's our bread and butter. You know, it keeps us alive. It keeps us awake through all the masses of data, and so we have to make sure that we represent the group, because we're all too certain that we can be wrong. You know, I've been wrong many times about things in the past. In the Anthropocene, you know, I thought originally that 1800. Was by far the best time to select. Now, I've changed my mind about that. 1800 does not work very well geologically. You know, things are too scattered in time and space for that. 1950 seems to work rather better, but we may change our mind on that, you know, in 2 years' time or 5 years' time.
What kind of objections might you anticipate destroying the whole project? I mean, what would be our evidence against the Anthropocene?
Well, one is simply the brevity of the whole thing. Remember, if we are talking 1950, we are talking, what now, the Anthropocene is 63 years old. You know, I've only just got, you know, I'm only just a little bit younger than that. The Holocene, for instance, is 11,500 years old, the Holocene epoch. Now, the Holocene is by far the shortest of the epochs. Most epochs in the tertiary, let's say, the average is about 13 million years, Eocene, Miocene, Pliocene, and so on. The average is about, some are 20, some are about 5, but that is the average. The Holocene has been, it's a special case. The last of about 100 major glacial interglacial changes in the Quaternary period, that is the last 2.5 million years. And we set it apart, partly because it has some human influence, and again, that is one of the arguments against. The Holocene already has human influence in it, so why should the Anthropocene be any different from that? And the other thing is that it's set apart because it creates distinct deposits we can tell apart from other rocks. So when the sea level came up 120 meters over about 5,000 years from the end of the Pleistocene epoch into the Holocene epoch, the world changed and geography started to build around it. All the big deltas built out, the river valleys formed, and all of that, all the soils formed. So they create the, if you like, the very substructure upon which we all live. So the Holocene, despite being very brief, has very good geological rationale. So what we have to do is make a similar rationale for the Anthropocene. We have to say, even though it is two orders or three orders of magnitude shorter than even the Holocene, it works geologically. You know, so the brevity is one thing, the human influence, and just how much change there has been from, let's say, late Holocene into Anthropocene times, and is it really so sharp, or is it so gradual that you know, somebody working in the field can't tell the difference? Do things happen differently in time and space? So China has a different history from Germany, from Britain, from Peru, and so on. We're trying to now measure very small intervals of time. When I measure rocks in the field, Siluran rocks, I'm looking at error bars of, if I get an error bar of less than 200,000 years, I think I'm doing really well. Here the error bars are decades. So these are all the things that can get thrown at us in no uncertain terms.
Sure. And I could also see if a lot of people are persuaded by some of the claims that are made or are launched as possibilities in the brochure, such as completely upsetting our understanding of science, completely upsetting our understanding of nature. If those claims are attached to the Anthropocene in the future, that may also make people skeptical.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a way, the enthusiasm that may be generated by the term is something that in the scientific frame is something to be a bit worried about.
It's a rather frowned upon, indeed. Yes, and in fact, there was a paper out in GSA today, last year, which came out saying, is the Anthropocene geology or is it pop science? Was the title.
Yeah.
And they were arguing, in fact, that it was pop science. Now, we did, as a group, we responded to that and said, well, there's all kinds of interesting, exciting and new things about the Anthropocene, and it has not been settled by any means, but it is a serious form of study. But certainly one of the things that will make the traditional stratigrapher, a member of what I think Brian Lovell, a former chair of the Geological Society, called a member of my tribe. What will make them nervous is the fact that the Anthropocene is important. It can be used for as a context to understand where we are, and also as a context to do things like make laws, even.
What makes them nervous.
That's what makes them nervous, yeah. Because it is loading the dice of a decision, and so I think it will take some time. It's not a blanket thing, but I can see among members of the community, this kind of thing is very new, and it upsets the purity, if you like, of the stratigraphic, you know, the geological historical decision making. You know, to suddenly have something that it might matter to other groups and rather large groups of people, whether the Anthropocene is made formal or not.
So I think we need to keep that in mind, right? That there are these constraints which haven't changed in the last 100 years. I mean, the standards of objectivity may have shifted in some ways, but still the sense that this be a neutral decision made outside of any kind of political influence, outside of any kind of cultural shading, any kind of personal interpretation, outside of any kind of theological frame is essential to the success of the term scientifically. And nevertheless, it seems for the impact of the concept to reach the scale that it needs to, we need to entertain those possibilities at the same time. Yep. We need to invite the humanists, the poets, the religious thinkers to see if indeed a new nature, a new cosmology, a new understanding of the universe that forces some of those very definitions of science, its method, its understanding about the world and humans' relations to it, those shifts might have to happen. Yeah. In a safe setting, perhaps, where all we do is deal with culture, the house of the cultures of the world.
Yeah, very, very much so, because the Anthropocene is out there, it's being used. And as a geologist, I say, it's great. Stratigraphy is finally popular. Wow. that's unheard of. So yes, you know, I agree completely with John about that. And I see the red light is on down there. So I think that's a good point to throw open this whole argument to all of you, if you'd like to join in the discussion. And John and I will try and answer as best as we can. Are there any questions at the... Yes, of course, yes, shout out, please, yes. The Anthropocene doesn't always work, you see.
And I have to think about what I'm saying. That what strikes me about what I've seen of this conference is that now the Maya are a particular group, and they're a civilized group, obviously, for 5,000 years, and they're not to be confused with hunters and gatherers, although there are some Maya in the Lacandon who are hunters and gatherers. But what they share in common is an outrage about what's going on in the planet. Mm. And I'm wondering if sometimes when you're so involved in this science that it doesn't get in the way of some just sort of basic outrage on your part as to what's going on that you see right in front of you in the way that the Maya would react in terms of cutting down trees in front of them and having palms put in, or oil palms, or, I mean, I could list 20 things that are happening to the Maya in Guatemala and Mexico where they're absolutely outraged at what's going on. And here we are talking about these things which seem infinitesimally small to them. I mean, I don't think they would even know what you were talking about, frankly, which isn't to say that I don't respect what you're talking about and don't understand it. But sometimes I wonder, and this is my question, if that rage that you have and that love of the planet is not more important than defining this scientific point.
Well, it's a very good point. And of course, we geologists are human too, at least some of the time. One of the things is how we can be effective in that. Now, if, and I'm very aware of this, if the Anthropocene is for real and becomes formally for real, then it will help some people who can make some practical difference to all these things. That is the idea. So, for instance, you know, one of the members of the working group is an international lawyer. He works on the international law of the sea, and where he's coming from is he says the whole law of the sea is based upon a stable planet. Everything to do with national jurisdiction, you know, boundaries and all of this, fishing rights and so on, is based on a world not changing. Once all this starts to change, once sea level starts to rise, once the boundaries begin to blur, once islands begin to disappear, you know, then everything is up for grabs. Now, one of the things that can actually then help, the things that is a better legal framework which can cope with this and maybe even stop some of this happening. So I think, in some ways, what I can see is that if we are, to some extent, cold and dispassionate about the argument and the evidence, that evidence will carry more weight and be more useful than if we expressed outrage or anger that is felt out there. You know, I can assure you of that. Alarm as well amongst my colleagues and all of these things. But we have to try and do something. We have to try and be effective. That is one thing. And if we use, I say, the Anthropocene, if we particularly, in our role, use that as an argument, we may lose the whole thing, at least that part of the story. Because, you know, we would not have the trust as saying white is white and black is black, and this shade of grey is this shade of grey, and this green is that. And I don't know if that's something, I mean, John, is that a...
Well, the first thought is, what would a house of the natures of the world look like? That would include the Mayans and their sense of offense and rage and you know, real anger at something being violated that we can only study in these cold, dispassionate terms. That's just one thought. But I think there's something downstream. I mean, as a strategy, this makes perfect sense. This is the culture we live in. Among the highest values that we hold are those of science, objectivity, real facts that are made. So if one is to make a change within that culture, it makes a lot of sense to work with the tools and the understandings of that culture. But one of the most promising and kind of exciting thoughts downstream is that in analyzing the physical transformations that have been made to the globe, to explain the causes for those physical transformations, someone is going to need to fill in an explanatory gap, which is, why is there this takeoff in 1950? And then science, right, with all its dispassion and yet all of its cultural authority as well, will be able to say, this is a moment when consumerism, when economic models of unlimited growth, of unlimited accumulation of capital were set up as values in this culture. And the cause of these physical transformations were these cultural values. Just as we would want to have physical cures for physical causes, right? Physical ways of adjusting to harms that were physical. In this case, we're going to need to change our culture. That's an argument that's now usually made by people outside the sciences. That argument can now be made with all the authority, with all the factuality that science has behind it within our culture. I don't think we're there yet, but I'm certainly the germs, the possibility of it is there in the way in which you're so carefully putting together the argument about the Anthropocene. So that it becomes a way of putting scientific weight behind values of judgment, judgments of value, both.
We hope.
Yes. Yves Cochet from Paris. There is a kind of controversial debate about the beginning of Anthropocene. But my question is about the end. Suppose that humanity all go in 2050. No more humanity. That will be one century for Anthropocene. For Anthropocene from humanity. But some consequences will be after that. For example, with radioactive material or climate change will last longer. So suppose now there is an alien geologist in 1 million years coming on Earth, and for him, will Anthropocene last 1 century, 2050, or more years, because, for example, of climate change and radioactive element?
I think the latter. It will, the Anthropocene, say we are starting something, and some of the effects are temporary. If we disappear in 2050, let's say there is some plague or some all-encompassing nuclear war or something like that, we all disappear. Then something's our physical remains as buildings and so on, and roads and bottles and you know, all these sorts of things, which can preserve as fossils in some cases, they will form what's called an event layer, you know, which will encompass a very small amount of time. But other things will last longer. The carbon dioxide that we by then will have put out, by then we should be around about 480 going on 550, you know, ppm, parts per million, so double the normal level. And simply to get that out of the atmosphere will take tens of thousands of years. It's a very slow process, drawing the CO2 and therefore all the warming effects back in. Probably by that stage there will be knock-on effects, the methane and all of that, so there'll be positive feedbacks coming in, because that is a lesson of the past. That is what has happened before the end of the Paleocene epoch. We had a natural release of carbon dioxide, which started like that, and then whoop, down and up, and then finally down over about 100,000 years. And that kind of thing we now know happened several times in the last 100 million years. There have been what are called these hypothermals. We are starting a hypothermal, and geology tells us that these things normally go on for 100,000 years. Now, the biological effects will last much longer. You know, because once you remove a species, it has gone forever. You know, so that is up and gone, something else appears, and so on. So there will be a set of signals in the rock. And I suspect because we've come in pretty much like a meteorite, and the effects will be indistinguishable from that of a meteorite at that kind of level of time, in millions of years' time. But the meteorite changed things at the end of the Cretaceous. So we have a kind of analogous situation. The question is, how big will that get? It won't be small. What we have done already won't be small and distinguishable. But I think the layer, there will be an event layer. But going beyond that, there will be other signals going on and on. So the Anthropocene, or their name for it, whatever it will be, will probably encompass either some substantial fraction of a million years or maybe even longer. 1, 2, 3, 5 million years. If we really break down the ecosystem, it normally takes down something like, you know, 3 or 5 million years to bring it back into comparable levels of diversity. So there are very good analogues in the past for this sort of scenario. Sorry? Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, my question goes, I would like to know more or less what is the need of defining something like the Anthropocene, because I feel, as you mentioned, it's been taken as this pop science. And I have this feeling that we are getting, because we come from this Christian Occidental point of view or view of the world, this idea appeals to our need of guilt and our need of flagellation, and at the same time appeals to our sense of power of changing the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a really kind of enticing and appealing paradox.
Well, yes, I'll probably mainly pass you on to John for that, but if I can just very briefly say that, you know, this is partly the first question. You know, we are trying, at least in scientifically, we are trying to be dispassionate about it and simply compare the levels of change, regardless of who or what made it in terms of the geology. You know, and the whole thing of using it, of looking at it within, if you like, John's version of the cosmology, you know, is something where that debate might be taken in different directions, I think.
Yeah. Already in a couple conversations, people have been talking about the bad and the good Anthropocene as two possibilities. And I think the good Anthropocene that you're talking about, it is a really remarkable paradox, because that gives us a sense of, yes, we created this mess and we can fix it, right? We shaped the world. Nature is our creation. We're responsible for all of it. And now we can fix it. That's what's called the good one. But that one is absolutely the height of human hubris, right? That's the kind of thinking that I think got us into this mess. There's some flagellation from the Christian tradition, if you'd like. Then there's the bad Anthropocene, which is another take, right? Which is just as much part of the story, which is that we made this without ever intending it. These are the results of things that we did for one purpose, and then the consequences are another. So I certainly wouldn't say, because there is this heritage, right? These are already tropes in our cultures, right? That have histories which have aspects of them that are lamentable. Therefore, we need to come up with concepts that are outside of any possible heritage. First of all, we can't do that, right? But second of all, I think the term itself, as you say, has this interesting paradoxical potential. On the one hand, it reassures us of our great power, both to create harm and then to cure it, but also reminds us that the system's absolutely out of our control, right? Our plans to improve the world, right, to improve our lot in life, have resulted in these disasters. And that's a humbling result. So you can't criticize us for both being too prideful and too humble, right?
No, but I'm interested to know why one is called the good one and why the other one is called the bad one.
And I think we could flip it.
The effect, yeah. The effect is simply the effect. The earth will do what it does. And that we as John said, I think currently we're not very good planetary managers. We're not very experienced at running this machine. We don't know how to do it, so it will do what it does, and we will simply have, as human beings,
isn't that idea sort of wrong to think of that we're driving this machine? Like
no, because the idea is that we have changed it already so much that it will evolve to a different state, one we are not so comfortable with. The people who say we should change it, at least the least. The most conservative thing is simply to try and do less of what we know takes the planet into a different state. Produce less carbon dioxide, do less deforestation, and all of these sorts of things. So that, I think, is more or less along the lines of the good or the gentle Anthropocene. The smaller Anthropocene, let us shrink the Anthropocene. So if the whole concept goes away, I think I would jump up and down and shout and throw a wild party and all these things if we had no need of an Anthropocene. I'd buy everybody in this auditorium a drink, two drinks, if that was the case.
But I do think that's a wonderful point, that there is within the discourse around the Anthropocene an incitement to say we should seize control of the situation, because that's been the view we've had of nature all along. This is where I think an alternative view of nature is provoked and necessary, where we have to recognize that nature has, you know, the world that we're part of and that we're making has forces in it, has an agency within it that a will to control is not going to be able to dominate. And therefore, a new sense of nature, perhaps an animistic conception of nature, where there's an unpredictability to the natural world, where there is a moral value, an agency granted to
the
non-human world,
respect,
those good old traditional Western values might have a place even in the central institutions of our society.